I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today, news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is Rabbi Irving Yitz Greenberg, author of The Triumph of Life, A Narrative Theology of Judaism. We'll also have a visit from Tom Price, our expert on the international Jewish scene. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the hosts and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom, and for some of you, Chag Sameach u'Moadim l'Simcha. A happy final day of Passover, but only for some of you. I will explain. For those two Jewish listeners who are Orthodox or conservative Jews and live outside the land of Israel, Chag Sameach, a happy and healthy last day of Passover and a Zisan Pesach. For those of you who are Reform Jews or live in Israel or simply don't think it makes any sense to observe 8 days for a week-long festival of matzah, Mazel Tov on the first day after Passover. Which reminds me that it's time to play our annual rendition by Michelle Citrin of her quite wonderful and slightly ridiculous song, 20 Things to Do with Matzah Now That Passover's Over. This one, an update she did a few years ago.
Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? You can make some matzah cards and play with your friends, or you could wear a matzah costume for Burning Man. You could make a cover for your iPad or your iPhone. Stuff it in a pillow, it's better than foam. If your table is uneven, you can make a matzah shin. Or you could play a matzah football game and flag it to win. Make a matzah greeting card, a window cover for your car, a slide for your G.I. Joes. Make a matzah fan that blows. Passover's over, and wouldn't it be neat if you could use all the matzah that you didn't eat? Go into your garden and spread some matzah mulch, or you can have a matzah contest for the loudest crunch. Make a matzah pyramid like our ancestors did, or you can make a matzah viewer box and watch an eclipse. Crumble up some matzah to make drywall paste, or you can make a matzah backsplash and spruce up your place. Make a macro matzah brew, a palette for your reds and blues. Share it with those in need. There's so many mouths to feed, there's so much to do with all the matzah you have. And you can still eat it, 'cause it never goes bad.
That was Michelle Citrin, a past guest of Too Jewish, with 20 more things you can do with matzah now that Passover's over. My favorite line is near the end about matzah. It never goes bad. That is totally true. For one thing, it can't go stale since it starts out that way. For another thing, once it's baked and stuck in a box, it will outlast global warming, asteroids smashing into Earth, MAGA, and very likely nuclear explosions. And you could use it next year for Pesach if you're not too particular about your shmurah restrictions. And you know what it'll taste like? Matzah. Hey. My favorite discussion about matzah is people who tell me, really, Rabbi, if you put butter and salt on it, it's fine. Of course, that's true of the box the matzah comes in, too. In any case, we're in the period now of the counting of the Omer, the time between the beginning of Passover and the holiday of Shavuot, The 7 weeks that extend from the second night Seder of Pesach, that great festival of freedom, until the night of Shavuot, the holiday of receiving the Torah and entering into the covenant of Sinai. Each night of this period, we perform a brief ritual, counting the Omer, reminding us of the ways our ancestors brought a special grain offering to the temple in Jerusalem, connecting them especially closely to God in this period. These subsequent 7 weeks create a time for deepening that freedom of Passover through the slow and steady work of self-exploration, examining habits of thought and behavior that keep us enslaved. The setting of the counting of the Omer that we'll play this morning on Two Jewish includes the introduction to a blessing that's used by Sephardim and Hasidim. It reads, "For the sake of the unification of the transcendent creative power with the divine presence dwelling here and now, I am here, ready to fulfill the mitzvah of counting the Omer." This composition is by Sam Benjamin Shiryakov Feit. Performance is by Yosef Goldman, Deborah Sachs-Bintz, and Chava Mirel singing. Joey Weisenberg on mandolin, Zach Fredman on guitar, Daniel Ori on bass, and Megan Wieder-Gould on violin.
Shem Yichud Kodesh HaBrichu U'Shchintei Hineni Muchan U'Mezuman Lekayem Mitzvat Aseh Leshem Yichud Kodesh HaBrichu Hineni muchan u'mezuman lekayem mitzvat aseh shel sfirat ha'omer shel sfirat ha'omer shel sfirat ha'omer shel sfirat Shabbatot Temimot Tiena Sheva Shabbatot Temimot Tiena Shanu Mitzvotav V'tzivanu Al Sfirat HaOmer Al Sfirat HaOmer Al Sfirat HaOmer Al Sfirat Shabbatot Temimot Tiena Sheva Shabbatot Temimot Tiena Oh,
The Sfirat HaOmer, for the period of the counting of the Omer between Passover and Shavuot. We are now entering the second week of the 7 weeks of counting each day, so that we may make each day count. Speaking of counting, we have a wonderful event coming up next Sunday at Congregation Beit Simcha. My father, Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan, a multiple past guest of Two Jewish, will celebrate his 99th birthday Sunday, April 27th at 2 p.m. at Beit Simcha with music, tributes, his favorite foods, bourbon, cake, and ice cream. You can go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, and wish him a Mazel Tov on his 99th birthday, or just call 520-276-5675 to attend. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is the extremely important modern Orthodox rabbi, Irving Yitz Greenberg. After a lifetime of exceptional accomplishments on behalf of the whole Jewish people, Klal Yisrael, he has turned his talents to a comprehensive theology, a systematic approach to Jewish belief, and written a book about it. Meet him when we return in just a moment here on Two Jewish. We are delighted and honored to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Irving Yitz Greenberg is a preeminent Jewish author, teacher, organizer, and theologian. He has a new book out, which has been called his magnum opus, The Triumph of Life, A Narrative Theology of Judaism. We're thrilled to welcome back to Two Jewish Yitz Greenberg. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Nice to be on the program. Thank you for inviting me.
So you have done almost everything in the Jewish world, I think it's fair to say. You've now turned your kind of thoughts to a comprehensive theology. Tell us why.
Well, probably because I have one of the themes of my life really has been the sense that we're living in a very special transformative moment. Really, it's a century. Jewish history, to my mind, the most momentous and transformational century in all of Jewish history. And the challenge is, obviously, can the Jewish people meet this challenge? We had the greatest destruction, the greatest redemption and exodus of in our lifetime to meet this challenge. And I have, in all my work, in the activism and so on, tried to respond to this challenge of what can you contribute to this period, whether it be activism for Soviet Jewry, whether it be attempt to develop educational resources and for the American Jewish community, or strengthen a relationship with Israel. But I would say that given that background, I gradually came to feel that one of the main challenges was a narrative. Unlike any previous century, people are not sheltered. For much of the human history, not just Jews, but every religion, raised people inside a kind of a cultural shelter. For the first time in history, however, its society was so open and so communication-rich that people were exposed to every other view of life. So it came to my conclusion that we can't depend on the old sense of separation or even rejection by Gentiles and of Gentiles, that the key need was a narrative, an understanding of life that could hold the tension, hold and support identity in an open society. And that, of course, led me to write quite a bit theology and eventually to try to write this book, Triumph of Life, which is a kind of a cumulative or a total interpretation of the whole religion.
We will talk much more with Yitz Greenberg about theology, about Judaism, about Israel, and his extraordinarily important, I think, new book, The Triumph of Life, when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a fabulous Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established 6.5 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school is available for next year for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. And coming next Sunday, April 27th at 2 p.m., celebrate the 99th birthday of Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan at Beit Simcha. He's a national Jewish treasure. We'll enjoy his fantastic music, celebrate his many accomplishments, and enjoy his favorite foods, cake, ice cream, and bourbon. Details are at BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Send him a tribute and attend. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m. Shabbat morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. with services at 10 a.m. Join us if you can't do it in person on our Facebook page for services, or come on Zoom for all of our Adult Education Academy classes taught live and virtually. For more information about Beit Simcha to come to services, my dad's 99th birthday celebration, our great religious school, Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes stores, very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, Corner Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
888-7470.
And now, in honor of my father, Baruch Kohan's 99th birthday celebration, coming up a week from this afternoon at Congregation Beit Simcha, here's his wonderful setting of the Hashkivenu, Let There Be Love.
Hashkivenu, Adonai Elokeinu,
let there be love and understanding among us. Let there be love.
That was Let There Be Love, the Hashkivenu from Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan. We'll celebrate his 99th birthday this coming Sunday, April 27th at Beit Simcha. Sign up to come to this amazing event or send a tribute. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA, Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, last week we started talking about the kind of ethnic divisions of Judaism, talked about Ashkenazim and Sephardim, Jews originally from Germany, and then all of pretty much most anywhere of Europe, and then the Jews have descended from Jews of the Iberian Peninsula, from Spain and Portugal. Let's talk about the Edot HaMizrach, the so-called Eastern communities, and what that means and how that differs from what most people think about when they think about Jewish ethnicity.
Right. The Edot HaMizrach is the largest category and the most complicated and the most diverse in many ways. And what's interesting is that many people within those communities were taught or tyrannized in the 40s and 50s by the Israeli government, Israeli society, and also the American penchant for oversimplification. They were taught to think of themselves as Sephardim because they're not Ashkenazim. So there was a period in Jewish history when everybody who wasn't Ashkenazic was told and was considered as Sephardic, even though that was manifestly untrue. And a great example in the history of Israel is the Jewish community of Yemen, which is a very old community, looks and acts very different from other Jewish communities, has its own rituals and tunes and everything else. But they have nothing to do with Spain or with Ladino or with Sephardic culture. On the other hand, when Israel was looking at people in a very binary way, it considered the Yemenites to be Sephardim, which is completely irrational and erroneous. But that's an example of a large, important subset of the population in Israel that was miscategorized for decades. And you can go really across mostly Islamic world, starting in Morocco and going all the way east to Southeast Asia, if you want. In fact, all the way east to Hong Kong. And you'll find the same completely irrational error. But it gets more understandable, actually, when you talk about Moroccan Jews, because a lot of Moroccan Jews did come from Spain and Portugal and did speak Ladino and were Sephardim. But there was an older community in Morocco that predated that whole thing and that has nothing to do with Sephardic culture. The same, by the way, is true in Greece. You and I have both been in a community called Thessaloniki, where there are a lot of Ladino-speaking Jews who can trace their roots to Spain and Portugal. But there's also a much older community there called the Romaniotes, who date back to Roman times.
Right.
So there are communities that are mixed, like Thessaloniki, which was, you know, for many years considered the Jerusalem of the Balkans. And that is in Europe, but it was neither Ashkenazic nor until roughly 1500 was it Sephardic. Same can be said for the Jewish community in Turkey. There are a lot of communities in Turkey where the majority of Jews were immigrants from Spain and Portugal. In fact, the Ottoman Sultan at the time said the Spanish king must be a fool to get rid of the very people who are making him rich. And he told his grand vizier to outfit ships with nice clothes and great food and to entice Jews fleeing Spain to settle in the Sultan's dominion. So a lot of Jews in what was once the Ottoman Empire and is now Turkey, Greece, Bulgaria, Bosnia, et cetera, et cetera, a lot of those Jews do come from Spain or Portugal, but a lot, I mean, there's an ancient Jewish community in Antioch going back at least as far as the time of Jesus.
Sure.
And they have nothing to do with Sephardic culture.
Tom, thanks. I think we should explore some even more far-flung communities next week. We will talk then.
With pleasure.
Time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A Jewish young woman fulfills her parents' dreams by going to medical school and becoming a doctor. She does her residency, however, on a Native American reservation way up in northern Arizona. There, she falls in love with a Navajo man and elopes with him. Her parents, who expected her to marry a Jewish man, preferably a Jewish doctor, are shocked. They are estranged from her. But one day, a year or two later, she calls her parents. "Mom, Dad, I want to tell you we just had a baby, and we wish to honor both of his heritages, Native American and Jewish, in his name." Oh, say her parents. And what did you call the child? Well, says the daughter, I know you'll be happy to know we named him Whitefish. That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion, Shmini, third in the book of Leviticus, includes a dramatic and traumatic event. The tabernacle in the wilderness has just been consecrated, and the priests, Moses' brother Aaron and his sons, are beginning their service. God's presence fills the tabernacle. All is right with the people and apparently with the world. And then, suddenly, disaster strikes. Aaron's two eldest sons, newly ordained priests named Nadav and Avihu, offer Esh Zarah, strange fire, to the Lord. They're immediately struck down and devoured by divine flame, dying before the Lord. In the aftermath of this tragic shock, Moses consoles Aaron with peculiar words. He says, God says, by those brought near to me, I am consecrated and honored before the people. There is no mention in the Torah of whether Aaron accepted this as a just ending for his eldest sons. The text merely says, Vayidom Aharon. Aaron was silent. We do not know the young priest's offense, if there was any. We are not told what the strange fire was. God decrees atonement offerings are made for whatever sin the young men have committed, and the people are restored to God's favor. There is no further explanation of this in the Torah, although the rabbis later create a variety of possible explanations for the disaster. Maybe they were drunk. Maybe they offered sacrifices not ordered by God, or were engaged in some form of idolatry, or they were too arrogant and usurped their father Aaron's place. The truth is, we don't know why they died. Of course, that's not just true of tragedies in the Torah. We also don't know why most tragedies take place in our own lives, or why terrible things sometimes happen to good people. As Ben Sirach says in the text Ecclesiasticus from the Apocrypha of the Hebrew Bible, we have been shown more than we can understand. God keeps rationales private. We just don't know, and likely we will never know. So, what do we know? Well, we do know that Aaron's silence may be the only real response to profound tragedy and loss. Our own comfort and consolation may come only when we silently acknowledge our powerlessness. This seems small comfort indeed, but it is an honest appraisal of our ability to comprehend profound loss. May God keep all of us from tragedy, but may God also give us the strength of Aaron when we must face it, the ability to accept the painful inadequacy of our own explanations with dignity and courage. When we return in a moment on Too Jewish, our distinguished guest, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, a founder of Open Orthodoxy, a crucial leader in the modern Orthodox world and in reaching across all Jewish boundaries, for, well, generations, joins us to explore his own most important beliefs, find out what they are, and why he's written them now.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
The man who set fire to the home of Pennsylvania's Jewish governor, Josh Shapiro, the night following the first Seder of Passover, said he targeted Shapiro because of what he wants to do to the Palestinian people, according to a search warrant signed by Pennsylvania State Police. Law enforcement says Cody Ballmer, the 38-year-old Harrisburg resident, set fire to the governor's mansion based upon perceived injustices to the people of Palestine. How this will rectify them is not clear. According to the police warrant, in a 911 call immediately following the attack early last Sunday morning, Ballmer stated that Josh Shapiro should stop having my friends killed and that our people have been put through too much by that monster. The fire caused extensive damage to the historic governor's mansion, where Shapiro, one of the most prominent Jewish politicians in the United States and a prospect for higher office, had hosted a Passover Seder with his family earlier that night. No one was injured. The attacker brought a ball-peen hammer with him, intending to kill Governor Shapiro with it if he encountered him. Pennsylvania State Police said they have not yet determined whether to charge Ballmer with ethnic intimidation, that is, in effect, a hate crime. He already faces more than 100 years in prison for the incident. When he was being vetted as a possible Democratic vice presidential pick in 2024, Shapiro received numerous hostile attacks from the left because of his support of Israel. Some were pro-Palestinian terrorist progressives, called him Genocide Josh. Ballmer has been described by authorities and family members as mentally unstable, not taking his medication, and harboring negative feelings about Democrats and other political issues at the time he conducted his attack. After his arrest, he stated that he intended to kill Shapiro. His mother told police she tried to have him hospitalized 2 days before the incident, but police determined at that time he did not pose a violent threat. Obviously, they were quite wrong. Last week, U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi condemned the attacks as absolutely horrific and added, "We have been praying for Josh, for his family. Those photos, it was horrible. I firmly believe they wanted to kill him." Yep. She declined to name the attack as an act of domestic terrorism, but said federal authorities are assisting in the investigation. FBI Director Kash Patel called Shapiro in the wake of the incident. President Donald Trump, in his unique manner, separately described the suspect as probably just a whack job. As Donald Trump took office as president in January, many who kept a close eye on Israel's efforts to blunt Iran's nuclear ambitions believed the timing was ripe for a decisive military strike. Iran had been deeply weakened by Israel's military response to Iran's own attacks on it and by Israel's successful wars against Iranian proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah, as well as by the collapse of Iran's ally, Syria. Trump was seen as open to being convinced to provide the crucial U.S. support necessary to pull off an attack on Iran's fortified nuclear sites. Ultimately, however, Trump turned down a specific Israeli plan for a strike that was to take place in May. Instead, he is apparently favoring diplomacy for now, opening nuclear talks with Iran last week, but vowing that the cost will be high if they fail. Apparently, the White House talks were much more of a setback for Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu than he let on when he came to the White House earlier this month. During a private meeting, Trump told Bibi that the U.S. would not support an imminent strike on Iran. Netanyahu's trip was precipitated by U.S. officials telling the Israelis that the White House was backing away from the idea of an Israeli attack on Iran. Trump revealed the plans for direct negotiations during a joint appearance with Netanyahu. Some in the Trump administration initially supported Israel's plans, but the tide turned. Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and Vice President J.D. Vance all were in opposition. Vance argued that the U.S. could back an Israeli operation in the future if the talks failed. That is notable because Vance tends to oppose U.S. intervention in foreign conflicts reflexively. He was the lone voice of skepticism about the U.S. strike on the Houthis in Yemen last month, according to the very well-publicized Signal chat that a Trump official added journalist Jeffrey Goldberg to, quite illegally. Iran is seen as a threat not just to Israel, but to the United States. They can't have a nuclear weapon, Trump told reporters earlier this month about Iran. If it requires military, we're going to have military. Israel will obviously be the leader of that, but no one leads us. We do what we want. My friends, freedom on this Passover has not been universal for Jews. While Agam Berger was finally released from Gaza during the ceasefire at the beginning of 2025, after over 16 months in captivity to Palestinian terrorists, he wrote in an essay published in the Wall Street Journal, "I will celebrate this holiday with my family, but it won't yet be full. There are 59 hostages still held in Gaza, 24 of whom are believed to be alive. This is their second Pesach in chains of iron. We can't allow a third." Yarden Bibas, of course, returned to the devastating news his wife and two young sons were murdered by Palestinian terrorists during captivity in Gaza. I am here and so thankful for this, but I am struggling to celebrate while I still haven't processed what I have lost. And when I know that my friend David is still in a tunnel, he wrote, referring to his best friend, David Cuneo, who remains a hostage to Palestinians. This Passover holiday arrived amid renewed fighting in Gaza and very few signs of an impending deal that could result in the release of the remaining hostages. While President Trump said last week negotiations were getting closer to such a deal, clearly the pace of talks has slowed since Israeli officials retook the lead from U.S. officials. As we conclude Passover 5785, all remain not yet free. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Irving Yitz Greenberg is kind of a legend in Jewish life. He grew up in Brooklyn, went to, you know, some of the best schools, eventually got his PhD in American history from Harvard. He is, I think, an extraordinary rabbi, teacher, and organizer. He has been a professor, founder and chairman and professor in the Department of Jewish Studies at City College of New York, teaches on the faculty of the very important Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, was the president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership, Klal. In the interest of full disclosure, I had the privilege of studying with him, and I will tell you he is a crucial figure. Yitz, you, I think, are the first one that I can recall formulating the centrality of the ethic of Jewish power. Can you explain why that's so important in your own theology and how that can be used for good?
Thank you for those kind words. The answer is, for the age we live in, again, first of all, as I mentioned, the modern period has created a tremendous expansion, explosion of human power. And that is a great accomplishment. But that unlimited power, almost unlimited power, is available to evil as well as to good people. You might say that this tremendous power, whether it be political, military, industrial, transportation, the Nazis concentrated all that power in one centralized drive to exterminate, really, the Jewish people. Unfortunately, the Jews were powerless. They did not have their own state or any land that would give them asylum. They did not have an army that might come and rescue them or fight for them. And so their powerlessness enabled the Nazis to use that force with total power, and as we know, the catastrophic result, the killing of 6 million Jews and the destruction of many, many cities, cultures, communities of Jewish meaning. Now, the only, by the Jews, we're not the only ones who learned this lesson. The lesson of the Holocaust and of World War II was grasped by everybody. If you're a potential victim of a vulnerable population, you must become powerful or protect yourself, or you will, in effect, risk the no limit of destruction. And I mentioned that we're not the only ones who grasped the after World War II, the anti-colonial revolts took place throughout the world. Israel and India led it off. After World War II and the Holocaust, we've had women's liberation, we've had African-American civil rights liberation movement, we've had gay liberation, and in this spirit, the Jewish people awoke from its tragic experience and realized that it has no choice but to take power. Creation of the State of Israel is the major example. A people with no military history or record or culture have created what is recognized as the fourth strongest army in the world and motivated people, again, with this background of no history, to fight, to give their lives in order to carry it out. So the truth is, though, this is the difference between this century. And had we not done this, I say again, had we not done this, we could have been wiped out again as the Arab nations tried to wipe out the state of Israel repeatedly. So taking power, A, is from a Jewish point of view, as it is from other vulnerable populations, essential to life. The second point which I make in the book, however, is that taking power is the central achievement of modern culture. Namely, its message was to all of humanity, take power, don't wait for a divine redeemer, don't wait for accepting status quo, take charge of your life in politics, democracy, in economics, capitalism, and socialism, and so on. If you will take control, you can create wealth, you can overcome sickness, all the messianic Jewish dreams of making this world full of life and so on were realizable if you take power. The difference is that because the Jewish religion married the idea of taking power and of human responsibility to an idea of a brit, a covenant, a partnership between God and humanity, between God and the Jewish people. So there were limits and controls that keep this healthy. What's happened in much of the world is that the power has gone uncontrolled. So you have industrialization leading to global warming and species destruction, and one could go on and on. So again, the Jewish people heard the call, I believe, in Israel particularly, but in America also, we woke up and realized we had to become politically active. So this has been the age, I call it the heroic age of the Jewish people, where the Jewish people takes power, and in this exercising this power at cost and at suffering and at courage, nevertheless, it is one of the great transformational moments.
You know, I think it was you that says it doesn't, I hope I'm quoting you correctly, it doesn't matter what movement you belong to in Judaism as long as you're embarrassed by it.
Yeah, that's a fair quote. I did say it. However, it was particularly a response to the Holocaust, and the reason being, because to me, that was my transformational moment. I grew up and was fulfilled and very happily living as an Orthodox, modern Orthodox Jew, rabbi, and
Riverdale and elsewhere, yep.
Then I suddenly stumbled. I was, in fact, an American intellectual history historian. I wasn't in Jewish studies. I sort of wanted to be an all-American boy.
Right.
Then I stumbled into the Holocaust, and it deeply, deeply shook me, including religiously and spiritually. It seemed to negate much of my belief in the Jewish tradition's belief. A loving God looks out for us, that life is stronger than death, and that this world will be improved and corrected to be a Garden of Eden paradise. It really was profoundly, and it struck me very difficult. On the other hand, it drove me to try to understand and respond. As I did, I came to realize again that none of the denominations really had an answer. None of them anticipated, or none of them had any uniquely effective response during the Holocaust. And bluntly, none of them, in my mind, had changed or responded enough after. So from my point of view, in effect, that's the origin of this joke. I mean, it wasn't a joke. Say, well, people said, well, what are you, if you're critiquing each denomination and each denomination needs to change and grow, what do you believe in or where do you stand? So my answer was, it's not so important which denomination you're part of as long as you're ashamed of it or embarrassed of it. Now, of course, when they asked me, so why are you Orthodox? My answer was, because I'm ashamed of being Orthodox, whereas you should be ashamed of being
Reform or conservative.
Or secular.
Or secular, right.
And by ashamed, I want to stress that. It's partly tongue-in-cheek, it's partly meaning to say, ask yourself what needs to be corrected. What, in fact, is not adequate to living in such a great time?
I sometimes get asked, you know, what's your Jewish background? And I say I was sort of pan-Judaic. I don't know that that's fair to mix Greek and Jewish terms.
That's a step, a big step toward embracing the whole Jewish people, by the way, and that was in my idea with the book, too. This was not written for a modern Orthodox audience alone. I hope it was not written just for a secular or a liberal movement audience alone. I feel the challenge of a narrative in our time is to speak across the whole spectrum. And I don't know how much comfort you'll get from this, anti-Semites, Nazis, but all anti-Semites, really in the end don't differentiate. And I think they're right. By they don't differentiate meaning, they don't just practice anti-Semitism toward religious Jews or liberal Jews or politically liberal Jews. They understand the Jewish people as a people, as long as it exists, is witnessing, is teaching the presence of God, the idea of a world of purpose, the idea of ethical responsibilities, the idea of partnership to build and improve the world. These ideas, in effect, all Jews carry. Good, some more and some less, and some maybe, in my judgment, mistaken ways, and some in not so in right ways. But that's a secondary factor. The basic factor, I feel that's our challenge, is to recognize that all Jews carry the message.
The book is called The Triumph of Life, A Narrative Theology of Judaism. I think it's an extraordinarily important book. Every Jew should read it and own it. Yitz, where can people go to find out more about you or to find out more about your book?
I do have a website. It's called RabbiIrvingGreenberg.com. Also, the Jewish Publication Society website, of course, has material about the book, and JPS actually published a couple of my earlier works also. And I'm also serving now as senior scholar at the Hadar Institute. And if you go to Hadar's website or publications or platforms, I've done everything from writing weekly commentary on the Torah to lectures on various topics, so on. So you can probably get more background, more lectures, more access to my thinking in some of those ways.
Thank you so much. Bizahundensfansik, just keep working. That's all.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your warm and kind words. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you and with your audience.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guests get a final musical play out.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Blake Flayton, co-author of the new book, 10 Things Every Jew Should Know Before They Go to College, an illustrated guide. Join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, each Friday night for services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush, in person and on our Facebook page. Join us next Sunday afternoon, the 27th, at Congregation Beit Simcha, the 99th birthday celebration of Rabbi and Cantor Baruch Kohan. Sunday, April 27th at 2 p.m., go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675 to sponsor and sign up for this remarkable celebration. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from my dad's music, his rousing anthem of celebration, Pitachta, from an album we recorded, some time ago, with me singing my dad's solo album is called Avanim Shabbat Rocks. My friends, if you are still observing it today, Chag Pesach Sameach V'Kasher, happy, healthy, and kosher last day of Passover. For everybody else, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.
Give us a dream.